Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Ma Vivrishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. So this question is saying how to keep that focus on what we call viveka, the viveka between the self and the not self, or the self and mithya. That's the basis of the question. How to kind of foster that discrimination. Okay. So. Well, first of all, that ability to discriminate between what is your innermost, what we call like the pratyagatma, the innermost self, the self that cannot be objectified. It's self-evident, self-shining, but doesn't objectify as an object. Like anything in the world and anything in your mind is objectified, and you can change it, it can come and go. So that's objectified. But so you can objectify the external world through your sense organs, you can objectify the physical body, which is external really, by your sense organs, you can objectify the sense organs through the mind, and you can objectify the mind and the self illumines the mind. Everything within duality can be objectified. The only thing that can't be objectified as an object is the ultimate subject. These things, the body, mind, sense organs, function as upadis. Upadi, that word translates sometimes as a conditioning adjunct. And what that means by conditioning adjunct is that I can actually take myself to be this. Where it probably, really, unless I was psychotic, I would not take, or enlightened, I would not take myself to be like the table or the rug or anything external to the body. But if the ahankar, the I notion, can land on this body or my mind or my sense organs or my emotions, like, oh, I'm so upset or I'm sleepy, it can land on the prana, you know, on the sensory, it's, oh, my sight is not as good as it used to be. Mm. It all belongs to me and mine, and I, me, mine. That's the ahankara, I, me, mine. You know, in terms of identification. And so, we don't have a problem with discrimination or viveka in reference to things external to the body, unless there's a psychosis or something. I don't take myself to be that. So even in chapter 13, when Krishna is describing what he calls the kshetra, and yourself as the kshetra-jna, kshetra means the field, and kshetra-jna means the knower of the field. It means the field of experience. But he limits that field of experience. It stops at the physical body because he knows very well that this field external to the physical body is not something that you need to have any type of discrimination for. And so this discrimination between the pratyagatma, this innermost self, what is actually me, and everything else that can be objectified, first takes place through the teaching methodologies that, like the Driktrisha Viveka, that seer-seeing differentiation. We just painstakingly go through that until you experience step by step that everything that you had identified is actually an object which you illumine, right? And which is continually changing. That which you're illumining is, because it belongs to some, to within time and space, it's continually changing. So we do that practice of consciously objectifying everything that can be objectified. And then the teacher will guide you in kind of a change of focus between the objectified object and the subject, right, because of which the object is known. It means the conscious being because of which this object can be known. So there's a change of focus between subject and object, subject and object. And then sitting, having like in a guided meditation or just in teaching, the teaching itself, giving you a chance to have the, for the buddhi to just, I always say, gently change your focus to just recognizing your being, the subject, you know. And then see what you are like. And then go back to the object, and then back to the subject, and then back to the object. So you can see the difference between your own presence and the objects that you're, whatever it is you're objectifying. So that's a practice that, because you, the mind is not used to doing that, it's used to just seeing everything as just one conscious mind, you know, and one conscious body. So we make the mind go through that practice of focusing on the object and then back to the subject. And then, as you get to know yourself, not through the lens of the object, whatever it may be, the lens of the mind or the lens of the body, then you can start to notice that these things, the mithya, what is objectified, is actually simultaneously experienced with the subject. They're different, right? The mithya experience can be differentiated from me, the me experience of just self-evident consciousness. So that then you start to recognize that all of the things that are coming and going, those are experienced. But the self is the, it's, we don't call the self as an experience because it's not objectified, but it is an experience. It's a changeless experience, and we only use experience then as self-evident, we mean self-evident consciousness. So it's not like your being is invisible or because it's not objectifiable, there's nobody there to know it. It is the very knownness that all things that are objectified enjoy. Like, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. There's nothing that's not known. But all of these things, actually, then we start to see that all things come into knownness and go out of knownness, and that knownness is just a synonym for the self-evident, for self-evident, self-shining consciousness, swaprakasha. Self-shining, self-evident, swatasiddha. Self-evident means your being doesn't require a pramana, a means of knowledge, to light it up. Like, I need my eyes to see this. If I don't have eyes, I can't see this. I don't need anything to see the self. The self does not need to be seen because it's self-shining, right? All mithya, all objectifications depend upon me for their knownness. No. And so I can differentiate the self-evident knownness of me, which is never the invariable. I can differentiate that invariable me from the continually changing objectified experiences. Now, that becomes very natural. But at first, it's not natural because I'm not used at all to differentiating the subject ultimately from everything I'd already taken to be myself. You know, so when that differentiation, we practice that and look at it and see it, then you start to recognize your own changeless presence, the invariable, you know, that is ever present to all the variables. The variables are the all the things that are objectifiable, right? And they're going on changing and changing and changing in the invariable presence of my being. And that becomes something that, first of all, from changing focus back and forth so that I recognize the invariable me, you know, I do that. Then I also recognize that this me, this invariable me, is invariable. It's never, ever, ever not there. And so then I start to know myself. The buddhi has differentiated itself and all the experiences that can possibly be had in your little range of experiences. It has differentiated everything, including its own self, from the adhishtana, the me, mm-hmm. right? And so that practice is something that is taking place, that vision is taking place almost in every class. If you're attending, say you're doing Shravana, that type of differentiation in one way or another is always taking place. And then in Nididhyasana, in meditation, that gives the mind a chance to just do that. To just get to really know yourself, to recognize yourself, to realize you're never not there. until it can't not recognize that. You know? And so that's kind of how it works. You know, how you foster that focusing. Now I like to use in meditation, I always kind of say, let the buddhi just gently focus on your own being. Why I say that is because you don't have to shut out the world. So it's like, let me focus on my being, that means the world should go away. That isn't true. The world doesn't need to go away. It's not causing any problem. It's mithya. It causes no problem at all. You just let the world be. Let the experiences be what they are. But your attention is just gently turned toward yourself, not bothering about if you have this thought or this perception is floating through or that. You hear some sound out there. The sound comes and goes in you. You know, it's not like the only way that you can be present is if the world goes away. This is simply not true. And so, but we can get that notion. It's kind of a yogic notion where the Prakriti in yoga, in the Sankhya yoga, the idea is that we have to bring the Prakriti, which means the whole universe of experience, objectifiable experience, into kind of an unmanifest state so that I can just abide as the Purusha. Otherwise, the Purusha is forced to have the experience of the Prakriti. They have the philosophy where the Prakriti is something real and the Purusha has to be detached from it. You know, but in order for it to be detached from it, it takes a lot of, on the side of the Prakriti, this body, mind, and sense organs is all made of Prakriti, it has to, through a lot of discipline, bring itself into an unmanifest condition. So I can talk for hours about that, but it's not really worth it. I'm just saying that Maya is not some real entity, you know, that we have to gain control over. It's all, instead, rather than that, it's about knowledge, you know. And the knowledge, the removal of the ignorance is what frees us of the problem, you know. Like if our mistaken notions, if the way we relate to the world is born of ignorance, when that ignorance is removed, then that way of relating is also removed. There's not too much you can do about that. It's not that you have to bring the world under control, you know, like lock it up or something. We don't have to lock it up. We have to come into relationship with it in terms of knowledge, you know. Like, for instance, as you become more and more clear, that the ananda that you're seeking in the world is really your own nature, your own being, once that is known, once that's assimilated, you know, then you don't have to do anything more about that. You know, because you don't have that notion anymore, and so you're not acting off of that false information, because it's not true. That type of thing. So it's a problem of knowledge and ignorance. It's not a problem of doership, or even though we like to be disciplined and all that kind of thing, there's nothing wrong with that. But what do you expect of your discipline? Do you think moksha comes from controlling the world, you know, or keeping the world away from me? That doesn't seem very liberating to me. One of us has to be in the jail. Which side of the jail are you on? It's not really freedom. So, I don't know, is that enough for that question?
Solipsism.
Oh, solipsism? Solipsism is a philosophical term. And sometimes Vedanta is mistaken as solipsism. Because if we say that this is how the mistake takes place, solipsism, I guess there's probably different forms of it, but the one that I'm usually, when I'm using the word, this is what I'm speaking of. Say if there's only one self. First of all, they don't think of the self when they say that. They don't think of the self as Brahman. Brahman is not a knower. So that also already is different. Brahman is not a knower. So there's one self. So that one self is me. Yeah. So if the one self is me, if there's one self, that one self is me, then all of you become like my imagination, my creation, my imagination. Yeah. And so that's solipsism, where everything that I experience is kind of like a dream, like a waking dream. And you're all part of my creation, and I'm the self of this creation. Where the self is kind of viewed as a jiva. As a jiva, as an individual, I'm the self, the truth of this whole projection. All of this is a projection. That's just in kind of gross terms what we call solipsism. And so now you can see that if we say there's only one self, then, you know, all of this is my creation. That's fine if you're talking from the non-dual Atma, which is the self of all beings. But it comes solipsistic when you're talking about the non-dual self, which is myself and not yours. That's the problem. Then that solipsism becomes really kind of crazy-making. You know, like you're my projection, basically. Rather than this whole manifest creation comes from the one non-dual self, which is the self in all beings and the self of Ishwara. It's very, very different. But it can be misunderstood. Because that question comes up quite a bit.
When you say that the problem there is that people think that Brahman is the knower?
That's a big problem. Because I always think, if I think of myself, this is why, if I think of myself as a conscious being, what I mean by consciousness is I'm the knower. I'm the conscious being who knows this and that and this, where a table's not a conscious being. It doesn't know anything.
So for the doership and the knowership, or the enjoyership, that same thing applies? Like, I'm trying to see how the agency of the jiva operates. Like, how does doership happen?
The doership is the identification with the body, right? Or the identification with the mind is the thinker. That, so I'm just kind of joking, say the ER, you know? The thinker, the doer, the walker, the talker. Yeah. So there's an identification then with the body or with the mind, you know, that enjoys these functions. And in terms of the mind or the means of knowledge, like the sense organs and the mind, then it has to do with more knowership. Like this, the ears hear. This is the hearer. This is the seer. You know, I'm the seer of this. I'm the one who heard this. That's ahankara. I take myself to be the instrument. Are there any more? Or are these your words?
Those are our words.
Oh, okay. Radha, I have a question that I posted.
Oh, did you write it down on Lisa?
Let me see. Yes.
Okay, I see. Okay, I'm going to do one more before yours, okay? Then I'll do yours.
No problem.
Okay. They don't understand how this thing works. They were shocked to hear you. Good. Usually nobody comes on, their voice doesn't come through, except for Edward. Only Edward.
I don't fight, I promise.
All right.
Just the type, right?
Yeah. Nirvikalpa samadhi. How is this different from moksha or self-knowledge? Okay, so it is an experience coming and going. Can this help to gain knowledge? Even without the pramana? Or would the experience make you seek a teacher? Oh, okay. How is nirvikalpa samadhi different from moksha or self-knowledge? Now, the nirvikalpa samadhi usually is a term that we use, technical term that we use in reference to what we call akhandakara vritti. It means where my mind, they have a vritti, in the mind that's really generated through the teaching that creates that nirvikalpa, no vikalpa, no see or seen vikalpa, just the experience of my own being. But say like many people have had a samadhi experience, which is nirvikalpa. So nirvikalpa means that just in that experience there is only my being, no subject-object differentiation at all. Swamiji will call that jada samadhi. Jada means inert. What inert means there is jada. It's free of any type of knowledge. It's an experience without knowing what that experience is, which means that when the mind comes back from that nirvikalpa state, right, it comes back from the nirvikalpa experience, it still says, I, me, the mind, had this wonderful non-dual experience. And you can say, I know that's the truth. Because you do. You know it's the truth, but you don't know what that truth is. Mm-hmm. And the ahankara is not... The ahankara remains as the self, as the little self, which is the mind, that it takes this, that I, the mind, have had this nirvikalpa experience. You know? And so the ahankara is not, doesn't make a shift. But in nirvikalpa samadhi, as part of the teaching methodology, what happens is that there's a context for that experience which causes the ahankara, the I notion, to make a shift to recognizing, because having negated all of what I used to take to be myself, but now I recognize is objectified, subject-object objectification. Now the ahankara cannot land on that, and it can't land on the body. That's made very clear. The body is objectified, and I remain the subject. And then we move in a notch. The sense organs are objectified, and I still remain the subject. Then the mind is objectified, I still remain the subject. So now, as I remain the subject and the mind becomes the object, the sense organs become the object, the body becomes the object, the world becomes the object, now what I've done is remove every point where the ahankara can land. It now has no place to go. And then what's left, and the mind is directed itself, it's directed and differentiated from the Atma, the self, which is, can no longer be the one who is innermost self. They say pratyagatma, the innermost self, because that self can't be objectified. You think you're the mind, but the mind is objectified. Or you think you're your sense organs, but they're objectified by the mind. Right? In fact, the sense organs are just instruments that sometimes aren't being used. Like, for instance, if your mind is thinking about something or daydreaming, your sense organs are just there. They're not attached. The mind isn't using them. So they're not working. They need you're daydreaming. You're off somewhere else. Your sense organs are just sitting there waiting for you. Mm-hmm. So Omji would always make fun of that. Because in class, sometimes, you know how you space out in class? You're there and you're trying to listen and everything, but at some point your mind just goes, and you're gone. So how do you think that looks for the teacher? When your mind has vacated the body. So he'll go like this. When he's telling this kind of as a joke, he'll go, you know, send to the sense organ, he'll be explaining, you know, the mind has to be using the sense organs, or no perception is taking place, like sometimes in class. You know, they have and they'll imitate the student like this. And he'll hold it for a really long time. It's the funniest thing. And his face is so funny. But it means that, you know, his body, it's just, you know, checked out, basically. Because the mind is off, you know, totally doing its own thing. So sense organs aren't functioning. You're in another la-la land. You're in another world. And then you come back. And you've missed a lot, too. Mm. You know? And you have no idea what you missed. Because you were not here. And another time when we usually so often experience this is if you're reading a book and all of a sudden you're... you've read a few pages, you have no clue. It happens to me with audiobooks also, because when I drive, I love to listen to audiobooks. And all of a sudden, I realize I've been gone for a long time. And I have to come back. I have to rewind for farther than I would even imagine that I would have to rewind. Because something tripped me, and I was off. It's very interesting. Yeah. Oh, so, where was we? Where were we? And what was the question?
So, can you just continue a little bit with the pramana?
Yeah, but I'm lost.
That's okay.
No, but tell me.
Well,
I can come back.
So we're just asking with the pramana, like.
Oh yeah, okay. I remember. Never mind. The pramana. So, when we have a nirvikalpa samadhi without the pramana, there's no context. So the context that is necessary for nirvikalpa samadhi to have the ahankara actually land on the self, on the aham. Ahankara means a false I, really. It's a creation of an I. You want that ahankara, you know, to be discontinued in a sense. The ahankara has to become mitya. Right? But the only way that can happen is if I experientially recognize the subject-object relationship between the things I used to identify as myself. If I've objectified the self and I'm still there as the subject, and I'm recognizing, oh, this self comes and goes, and this body comes and goes, and, you know, it's changing and all of that, and I'm there, differentiated from it, then that is ultimately not me. You know, in reality, it is not who I am. So you first have to show as false every point of identification. For the ahankara, it lands on the body, it lands on the sense organs. You have to show that they're objectified, they're instruments. It lands on the mind, it lands on the buddhi, it lands on the emotions. And in all those conditions, you can go very subtle also, even space is objectified. So you have this experience of separating into subject-object, things that you had just taken for granted as one. Now, when you've negated all of those positionalities where this is me and this is me and this is me and this is me, when you've negated all of that, then this ahankara doesn't know what to do. It doesn't have a place to land. That's just the right time, you know, to then focus on, the teacher will focus on the self, the one who's the constant, the one who can't be objectified. And that's where now the aham lands. Because I'm the one that is ever present to every experience I have. Nothing else is. So nothing else deserves the title of self, because if it can go and I'm still here, you know, it's not me. Because I'm still here, it is gone. That's not going to be me. And so we really disassemble the ahankara, the I notions, experientially leaving, having objectified all of these things. So this is the pramana, right? This drisya viveka. Having separated all of these things, I then am left with myself, and then the buddhi is left just with me, focusing on me, not with me identified with a given upadhi or conditioning agent. And so then, when that happens, I can just, even if it takes place in a split second or in 2 or 3 seconds, I am just with myself. But I'm with myself as myself. I'm not with the mind still having the ahankara, having an experience of myself, little self, big self, all this type of thing. And I, the little self, comes back because still the ahankara is there with the mind, that ajnanam, that ignorance, hasn't been removed. And so I have the wonderful experience and I know it is real, and then it's like, how can I get it again? How can I have that experience again? Where is it? What do I do, you know, to have that experience again? Whereas, in fact, that experience is ever present as my own being. It just has to be differentiated from the things that I've taken, that I've superimposed on it. And so that pramana, that's one of what we call the prakriyas, the teaching methodologies that is utilized, is used to provide the context, you know, having removed, you know, all of the false identifications, leaving me there. and then my buddhi, for having everything else removed, focused on me, then I'm just the non-dual Atma that cannot be objectified and need not be objectified. I'm ever present. Then I recognize, when all the experiences come back, I can recognize the stability of my being amidst all of those changing mithya experiences. Makes sense?
Yeah, so when we use the word nirvikalpa samadhi, we're only talking about it as an experience without the pramana or without knowledge.
Well, we can be if I'm using it with... I can use the term with knowledge because we have those terms, nirvikalpa and savikalpa. We tend to use, instead of nirvikalpa, the word akanda akara vritti. Mm-hmm. Means the nirvikalpa samadhi is a vritti, a thought modification whose form, akara, is akanda. It's not divided into any type of subject-object. It's non-dual. There's no subject-object. There's no differentiation. It's just simply my being. That's it. So that's akanda, undivided, akara, form. The form of the vritti is undivided. No subject-object. Spiritual bypassing. Spiritual bypassing, I think that word was actually, as I understand it, from way back when, coined by Ken Wilber. And but I think it's a really useful term. It's where
in this context in particular, like still having the small self, big self, for example.
Well, the small self, big self is a misnomer and totally born of ignorance, right? But spiritual bypassing is when I should just say, can say something. Well, that's, you say you have anger or hurt or your mind is reactionary or something, and you say, well, that's just mithya. You know, I don't have to do anything about that. That's just mithya. You know, doesn't make any difference. Yeah, that's spiritual bypassing. And so I just try to let myself be fine with my unruly mind or my hurting mind, because I think that shouldn't make any difference. It's just mithya after all. But you know what? It does make a difference, and it is hurting, and I don't want to be hurt. Mm-hmm. You know, and I am angry, and I don't want to be angry. But after all, it's just mithya, so it shouldn't bother me. You know. But that's like, you might as well take it to another level, a physical level, and say, yeah, my arm is broken, but you know, it's just mithya. What difference does it make? You know? You know? Or something just ran over my leg and it's crushed. Yeah, you know, it's just mithya. No problem. It's totally ridiculous.
And dangerous.
Like when you said about doing the scales and making a mistake, mm-hmm. How's that different from saying like, well, ouch, you know, I'm angry. Oh, but don't worry about it. I'll just work on that.
No, but then you're... Don't worry about it. I'll work on it.
Right. Okay.
Because I want to... You know, I want to kind of correct that habitual way of being, because it's really not in my best interest, and it doesn't resonate with myself. It doesn't resonate with my nature. It doesn't resonate with my knowledge. It's just a habitual reaction that is painful for myself and others, and I don't feel comfortable. It's uncomfortable. And so it's natural for me to work on it, you know? Just like it's natural for me to take care of my physical body if it's causing me pain. Mm-hmm. Now, when we're thinking about the physical body, doesn't it seem kind of weird if you meet somebody who says, oh, it's just mithya. Yeah, it's killing me. But It's just not.
Can I have my question looked at, or
1 minute? But you're right, Annalisa. I forgot all about you, but I see you right here on the. I see the question right here. I'm going to turn off your speaker. You already turned it off. Okay, don't worry. Let me sit here. Okay, I forgot what I was saying, so I'll do you, and then we'll go back to whatever it was so they can remind me. Are the emotions entities that reside in the body and products of the mind, not the Atma? If so, are emotions ultimately dismissible? If that is so, then what is the point of emotions in the order. Well, that's interesting. I'll say a few things.
There's more to it. There's one more part.
Oh, okay. In the larger order, if that is so, then what is the point of emotions in the order, in the larger order, that is? What is the function of emotions in respect to the mind? That's an interesting question. I don't think of the emotions as entities, like little entities floating around.
That's Eckhart Tolle.
Oh, really? He talks about them as entities.
Pain bodies, entities.
Oh, okay. Well, we can talk about those. If we talk about it that way, we're talking more like more about it like inner children.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are the emotions inner children? Are the entities that reside in the body and products of the mind, not the Atma? The emotions are not the Atma, right? The Atma, the self, is free of emotions. It's free of any kind of duality. It illumines everything. It illumines the body. It illumines the emotions. It illumines anything that comes in the form of a vritti, etc., is illumined. So emotions, if emotions are there in unmanifest condition in the unconscious, you know, then those emotions, as they rise up into consciousness, you know, are something that are experienced by me. And they're experienced because the sattva of the mind reflects consciousness, and then there's as though a superimposition where the consciousness, the knownness of consciousness, is superimposed on the emotion that is there in the sattva. And so the emotion is as though known, because the knownness belongs to the consciousness. It's interesting. The sattva, you know, allows for that superimposition of the knownness of consciousness with the experience in the mind. Okay, so let's see. So they're products of the mind, if you want to use the word products, not the Atma. If so, are emotions ultimately dismissible? The emotions are Some emotions are easily dismissed. Other emotions have to be really kind of transformed. You know, you have to be able to be with that emotion in a loving way in order for it to kind of release itself from the mind. Sometimes if you think of emotions as rising from the unconscious and you think of them as stress, you know, different levels of stress that come into the conscious mind, to let that go, and they also are stress in the body, to let it go, that stress has to be released. But to have it be released, sometimes it takes a good mother, you know, or some kindness, or understanding, or patience, you know, or welcoming of that emotion to allow it to release itself. And that's that type of inner child work that we do that can be really helpful. If that is so, then what is the point of emotions in the order? Well, the point of the emotions is they exist. I think negative emotions are... I think we really learn from our negative emotions and we enjoy our positive emotions. Mm. The positive emotions really naturally take place when there is Dharma. There's all kinds of different levels of positive emotion that take place, Dharma, and we learn from that. And we also learn that the negative emotions take place from some sort of abuse. You know, some sort of hurt, some sort of himsa, you know. And so we also learn from that. We learn over and over again, we are we use our emotions to guide our behavior, often, and to understand our behavior and the behavior of other people. So I think that they're directly related to dharma adharma. Yeah, there must be an order. I hope I answered the purpose. I don't have much more to say about that. I think I talked about what I thought the purpose of them was, if I have to make a purpose. I think that's the purpose that we discover. Okay, well, let's try to talk about it later, maybe when you come to class. You know, in Berkeley, we can have a discussion about it. It's kind of hard to talk about it in this way. Anybody else?
Did you want to finish what you were talking about?
Oh, hold on, please. Well, I have two questions. One about a word, Vesha.
What?
Vesha.
Vesha. You asked me about that in some long time. I didn't. I know, because I forgot about it. Vesha. How do you spell it?
V-E-S-A, you know.
Yeah, we don't know which S, the sha.
Yeah,
let me look it up. And how was he using that word?
So, he was talking about the mistaken notion, you know, that we are the body, mind, and senses. And he said this is only true at the level of Vesha.
Vesha.
This was in, like, the last time I was here, we were doing a Dvaita Makaranda.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that you were using Swami TV's version of that.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, when I get to India, I'll pick that up and then I'll read it, you know, while I'm traveling.
Okay.
But they didn't have his version. They had Swami Vidhitatmananda's version. So I was reading that. It was really beautiful. But there was no glossary, and he used this word, and he didn't explain it.
I think this is what it is. This is the kind of meaning of Vesha that I'm familiar with as a dress or an apparel.
Okay.
But let me read the whole thing, because it gets into more of a Vedantic concept.
Okay.
And it's a sha, lingual sha, Vesha.
Oh.
Yeah. So, it means dress, apparel, ornament, artificial exterior, assumed appearance, often also a look, exterior appearance in general. To assume means to assume a dress, to assume an appearance, concealing one's appearance, disguising oneself. So, I think I have to look at the context. But the Vesha could be like the Upadhi.
Yeah.
You know, like my mind. I'm experiencing myself from the standpoint of my mind. My mind is like a dress. The body.
Like
is
a costume.
Like a costume. Yeah, it's like a dress. Like in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a verse that says, you know, as a jiva, I go through, you know, birth and then childhood and then old age and then the body drops and I, like an old dress.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, and then I take on a new dress, mm-hmm. And so we're experiencing ourselves from the standpoint of the dress, or from the standpoint of the costume, not from the standpoint of myself. So probably he's using it like that.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see. You know that verse? He probably uses it. I have that. I don't think I might have it here. Even I know I have that. His book at home.
I don't have my phone here, but I know I.
Oh, you made a click
section
of it? Oh, I see.
No, I didn't. I didn't photograph it, but I told you which section it was, what he was talking about.
Yeah.
But I don't remember right now.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I... It seemed just from the context that that's what it was, but I wanted to understand. And then I wonder if you could talk some more, and I know you have recently, about samskara and vasana.
Yeah, that's
a
little
bit... Is it vasana or
vasana?
Vasana.
Okay. That's a little bit tricky because sometimes there's overlap. The samskaras, like sometimes, or there's many different meanings for samskaras. Sometimes you talk about the samskaras as the purificatory rites that we, that say a child does as they're growing up. There's basic samskaras or rituals that they'll go through. So that's one word, but when we're doing it like with vasanas, often samskaras are past life tendencies that are brought forward, you know? And vasanas, if we're going to make a difference, then vasanas are like subtle likes and dislikes, you know, that cause us to react. Subtle likes and dislikes, raga dvesha, Swamiji will call them, that kind of rise up from the past, you know, into the present. And so the word vasana actually means a fragrance. So Swamiji will use the example of, like, say you have, you know, like a vase of roses, and you take the roses out of the room, still the fragrance remains. And so say in the past you had certain experiences that you really liked, then you'll find yourself in, many years later, something comes up that reminds you of that, and you'll like it. You don't even, say even a person is like that. Say there's, so you had a really good friend, you know, in grammar school or something. They had a particular accent or just a particular way. And then you meet someone later in life, and they kind of remind you of that friend, and you immediately like them. You have the same feelings. That's a vasana, right? And negative experiences also that you had earlier in life, they leave a taste or a tendency, you know, or a fragrance and a subtle impression. You could say they leave a subtle impression. And then when you meet someone or something later in life, it can trigger, something about that can trigger that emotional reaction. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
That's often called a vasana.
Okay.
Now, Swami Chinmayananda used to say, well, you have to get rid of all of your vasanas. And he had the BMI chart, body, mind, intellect, and then there's the vasanas over here, up here, and om here. And so he would say something like, all of these vasanas have to be removed. Then Swamiji would say, there is no way to remove all the vasanas. Because then Swamiji Chinmayananda was talking of vasanas as what Swamiji was talking as the sanchitta-karmas. Sanchitta-karmas are unfulfilled karmas, right? And that sanchitta file is going, we call it, that sanchitta is infinite because your past lives are infinite. And so there's no way of exhausting all of those. So if you have to exhaust those limitless, basically countless karmas for liberation, that's an impossibility. And so it's not about exhausting the karmas, it's about recognizing that yourself is not a doer and has no connection with those karmas in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so that used to be this discussion. You know? It was not a big deal. But I'm just remembering it. Wait.
Today when you were talking about the infinite plane and how there's infinite lives in the past and so on, and then the behavior in those lives, I'm almost falling asleep, so I'm just having trouble. But infinite, like any subset of infinite is still infinite. So you had these infinite lives in the past, and so there must be infinite good karma and infinite bad karma.
Yes, but I suppose we can use this. Okay, to use the word
so
infinite.
So I'm just saying is, if you've had infinite lives, then all these different categories of behavior will also be infinite. I mean, if as a mathematician, that's how you would...
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So why should you have any particular kind of life at all? I mean, if you have infinite good and infinite bad, then...
Is it just a throw of the dice or something?
Yeah,
Which ones come up in the... No, because that's not what... What they say is at the moment of death, right, then there you are the culmination of who you are. And so what karmas will be appropriate and attracted to who you are at this moment, at the moment of death.
Oh.
And so those are the karmas, and in the given time and place and all that, which karmas fit you, you know. And that is why, in fact, that a jiva, within kind of the Hindu mythology or creation myth or whatever you want to call it, cosmology, why they take their behavior in this life so it's so important that they do dharma in this life, because it directly affects the type of birth they'll get in the next life. Mm-hmm. And that's also why when a person is dying, their family members will sit around and chant the name of the Lord. So that to try to help them, be the best they can possibly be moment of death.
So the karmas in this life then have more influence on your next life than all the karmas in your...
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Sanchitta file.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
But it's not during, all the karmas, how you are during this life, how you are at the time of your death. Right? That's all the growth, everything that has happened to you. Who are you at the time of your death? Right? When that moment of passing. And you can't fake that, because there's no more will. Everything is over and done with. So who are you at that moment is the one that is going to continue on. And so the karmas that are appropriate in this infinite sanchitta file are what will be attracted to you, and vice versa.
But it seems as though if infinite, that you have you always have the right puzzle pieces. Like, you're not going to say, well, the way that I am right now, I should have this next life, but my sanchitta file doesn't have the right karmas in it. But it would always have the right karmas in it if they're infinite.
I would think that's probably true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Though they do say sometimes you go into a causal condition, or you're also exhausting karmas on different planes, but eventually you take a birth here. But even then, the karmas that are kind of the prarabdha karmas are the ones that are appropriate for who you are. So, which is, you know, why Hindus take dharma very, very seriously, because it is important for who you are in your next birth, actually. And then for a mumukshu, it's much more than that. Because that you assimilate. I think as we grow, we assimilate the importance of dharma in terms of our own well-being, our own shanti. And a religious person assimilates that, not just a mumukshu. I think anybody, anybody assimilates it who's awake to their experience, who's paying attention. You know.
Just a vocabulary thing.
Yeah.
The two types of omniscience are
sarvajnaha.
Isn't there sarvajnaha and also sarvavit?
Yes.
Sarvavit.
Yeah, I said vidvat, which is another thing, but sarvavit,
that's of the particular, knowing all the particulars.
Yes, exactly.
Like only Ishwara has that.
How come you remembered that?
Sarvavit. I don't know.
That's very good. Yeah, my mind is going,
Swamiji is that.
Oh, yes, it's sarvajnaha sarvavit.
Yeah.
The sarvavit is the particular knowledge. In Mundaka Upanishad.
You studied the Mundaka. You taught me that. That's why I remember it.
Yeah. Why don't I remember it? I'm getting these little holes in my brain. Many little holes.
You have a problem with some truth that we all are.
What can we do? That's not bad. Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmanevya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. Kale varshatu parjanyah. Prithivi sasya shalini. Desho yam shoparahitah. Brahmana santu nirbhayah. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah. Sarve santu niramayah. Sarve bhadrani pashyantu. Ma kaschit dukha bhavet. Asato ma sadgamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya. Mrityorma amritam gamaya. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha. Hari Om.